Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 572, titled The Liberty Incident. This is being recorded on October 8th of the year 2006. In this program, we're reviewing the incident involving the USS Liberty. That was a U.S. spy ship that was attacked by Israel during the 67 war, the Six-Day War. As we have already touched upon, and as we're going to deal with at considerable length inside, too, the official versions on both sides of that, both the U.S. and the Israeli version, or BS, the attack on the Liberty was no accident. Israel knew full well what it was doing, and the U.S. knew it was no accident, and they knew why Israel was doing it. And basically, a modus vivendi was worked out between the Israelis and the U.S. to cover up the incident. Before we launch into Side 2, let me briefly review what we looked at in Side 1. One of the complicating factors with regard to people's understanding of what's going on in the Middle East, well, in the U.S. is so dumbed down at this point. The media aren't telling the truth, and now their faulty truth-telling is becoming even more skewed in light of the tremendous amount of Arab capital that's been moving into the U.S. and the U.S. media establishment and those of other countries as well. As the price of oil goes high and stays high, the tremendous amounts of capital that pour into the Arab oil-producing companies, or countries, I should say, as well as other oil producers, is then recycled into the Western economy. A lot of that has gone to buy media clout. And the U.S. educational establishment has been glutted, and there's all sorts of official lying from all sorts of directions. And as a result, Americans' understanding of just about everything is pretty badly skewed at this point. I'm sorry to say, I think that at this point in time, the average American couldn't tell a dirt road from a chicken with lips, which is really unfortunate. And that goes double for the Middle East. But although the U.S. is officially an ally of Israel, the fact of the matter is Israel doesn't have oil. The Arabs have tons of oil. The Saudis, for example, have always been the primary bankrollers of the Palestinians. And because of the fact that oil is the main source of power and wealth in the industrialized world, basically it is the business that talks loudest in U.S. Middle Eastern affairs. However, it speaks quietly and behind the scenes, but it is a very, very important voice indeed. If that sounds like hocus pocus to you, just bear in mind that how many people out there know that the most important, the top State Department official involved with Middle Eastern affairs is Elizabeth Cheney, Dick Cheney's daughter, who occupies a position created especially for her. And Dick Cheney was the head of Halliburton, major oil company with all kinds of security contracts and everything else. And it is the all business that basically determines what's going on in the Middle East. Although the U.S. is officially allied with Israel, and it is an alliance, the fact of the matter is it is a duplicitous alliance because of the fact that the Arabs have oil, and oil is the epicenter of power and wealth in the industrialized world. Now, in Side 1, we were looking at the run-up to the Six-Day War. In fact, although the Israelis attacked first, the Arabs were looking to destroy Israel before Israel was able to develop the atomic bomb. As we looked at in Side 1, the CIA had helped to pass information to the Arabs that indicated that Israel would not have a bomb developed by 1967. This was one of the things that led to the Arab timetable in 67 to wipe out the Israelis then before they had the bomb. We also looked at the fact that LBJ, Lyndon Baines Johnson, who was the president at the time, was, of course, from Texas and had a strong, strong background of alliance with the petroleum industry, which obviously wields a lot of clout in Texas. I would note that the current vice president and president of the United States are both former and petroleum industry CEOs from the state of Texas. As I noted, and as time permitting, we will review here, the U.S. ambassador to Israel during this time period was none other than Wally Barber, the father of Haley Barber, the GOP governor of Mississippi, and also the head of New Bridge Strategies, a very powerful company that has a lot of the contracts in Iraq. And New Bridge Strategies also is involved with, does cross-contracting with Bank Al-Taqwa. the Muslim Brotherhood Financial Institution, headed up by former Nazi spy Youssef Nada. He was also a major funding source for Al-Qaeda. And I would also note that Haley Barbour and his milieu, there's that word, are also involved with, among others, Victor Kozeny, the Alpha Group, and other institutions that are involved with the petroleum industry, illegal drug trafficking milieu, that overlaps the milieu of September 11th. We will, in the future, be returning to Kozeny and Alpha and Wolfgang Boringer and the curious associates of Mohammed Atta, head 9/11 hijacker in Florida. But where we're going to be picking up in the narrative that we're going to be presenting is after some petroleum industry interests have been able to persuade LBJ and the U.S. intelligence community to provide secret behind-the-scenes assistance to the Arabs, basically in order to curry favor with the Arabs, because we were officially allied with Israel. That obviously did not sit well with the Arabs. And again, the Arabs had oil. LBJ was a Texas politician. The rest pretty much took its course. And by the way, Wally Barbour was a right-wing Democrat with strong alliances with the petroleum industry as well. His son is a right-wing Republican with strong alliances with not only the petroleum industry, but Al-Qaeda and what I call the underground Reich as well, or with elements associated with that. Now, the agreement that was set up secretly between LBJ and the petroleum interests was to throw the Arabs a bone, so to speak, during the Six-Day War so that relations with the Arabs wouldn't be too damaged by official U.S. support for Israel. What the petroleum interests worked out was a deal whereby the U.S. would secretly pass intelligence on the Israelis to the Arabs during the Six-Day War. And it was the USS Liberty, a Navy spy ship with a powerful NSA contingent aboard, that was doing that spying. What the Liberty was doing was monitoring Israeli radio signals and then using those to form a very detailed and concrete picture of the Israeli order of battle in the Sinai on the Six-Day War and every place else. This was then being communicated to the Arabs, the Egyptians, in particular. After the Israelis defeated the Egyptian forces in the early part of the Six-Day War, some of their forces were selectively withdrawn from the Sinai front to staff up the coming attack on the Golan Heights in Syria. And one of the things that the Liberty was doing was providing intelligence on what units were being withdrawn so the Egyptians could stage a successful counterattack. And again, I view the account that we're about to read as altogether credible. The notion that this attack was an accident, which is what the U.S. and Israelis both officially adhere to, is preposterous. So are the other explanations, including the notion that the Israelis were trying to use this as a provocation to get the U.S. to attack the Arabs. There was no attempt at disguising the insignia on the Israeli aircraft or the torpedo boats. The attacks took place over an extended period of time. It would have been simple to sink the Liberty. And above all, the Israelis used napalm against the USS Liberty, the only instance I've ever been able to find of the use of napalm against a naval vessel at sea. Napalm is generally used against bunkered ground forces. And so it is at this point that we're going to resume the narrative. The narrative, by the way, comes from the book The Secret War Against the Jews, subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People, co-authored by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens, published in hard and soft covers by the St. Martin's Press. And by the way, the reference to the old spies that you'll hear here, the old spies were a group of veteran retired intelligence operatives from the U.S., Britain, Israel, and Russia, who basically wanted the truth about the long clandestine history that had obtained vis-a-vis the Jews in Israel and a lot of other things. What this book is really about, more than anything else, are the politics of petroleum. Because what's really going on in the Middle East, it ain't about Jews, folks. It is a three-letter word, but not J-E-W. That three-letter word is O-I-L. So again, having agreed to pass in secret intelligence on the Israeli order of battle to the Arabs, the USS Liberty was dispatched to that theater to do just the same. And it is at this point that we're going to pick up with Loftus and Aaron's narrative. The Egyptian generals were considerably easier to get along with. They desperately needed intelligence now and begged the CIA for its promised assistance. It wasn't long in coming. On June 8th, the morning of the fourth day of the Six-Day War, the USS Liberty arrived off the Sinai coast. Although its crew didn't know it, it was the only hope the Egyptian army had of retrieving anything from one of the quickest and most decisive military victories in history. The Liberty was more than a floating radio set. It was a giant magnet for electronic intelligence and could do much more than simply eavesdrop on radio communications. Anyone could do that. The nation of Israel is so tiny that the U.S. Embassy in Beirut could monitor all the radio traffic in the entire country. The embassy even taped the Israeli pilots talking back and forth when they hit the Liberty. For that matter, the Egyptian embassy in Jordan could listen to radio traffic, and it was a good deal closer than the Liberty. So what was the Liberty doing there? Our sources among the old spies have an interesting explanation. They believe the Liberty was making a war map. Every time an Israeli soldier squawked on his walkie-talkie, the ship recorded his voice and indexed it with the direction and the strength of the signal. The same thing happened with tank radios, headquarters telephones, even coded cable traffic. The ship swept up everything in the airwaves while noting the location of every speck of electronic dust in Israel. This is called a raw intelligence take. The Liberty was one of the most sophisticated spy ships in the world at that time. Even so, it wasn't big enough to process all the electronic garbage it collected. Processing intelligence requires banks of computers and teams of analysts. All the ship did was record the garbage, compress it electronically, and transmit it to a land station. What happened next was none of its concern. The crew members didn't know it, but the land station was located on the island of Cyprus. That was the clever part. The Navy's paper trail would show that no American computer had even begun to process the Liberty's troop movement data at the time of the attack. If asked under oath, the few officers involved in the scheme could swear that the ship never gave any Israeli secrets to the Arabs. They would be telling the truth as far as it went. The British Secret Service has one of the largest electronic listening posts in the world on the island of Cyprus. It had little difficulty in downloading the transmissions from the Liberty. All of Israel's electronic garbage was sifted by an enormous computer that began to make sense of the random noise. One section of the British computer began to decode Israel's cable traffic. Another went to work on plotting the military radio transmissions, while still another began to sort the telephone calls intercepted from microwave relay towers across Israel. First, the frequencies and locations of the major Israeli headquarters were identified, then the smaller regiments and battalions, then the individual units. A great deal of preparatory work had been done before the war began. Spectrographic analysis of known voice prints enabled the computer to identify each Israeli commander as soon as he spoke on the radio or telephone. The voice was matched to a name and unit number, and then the unit's location was placed on an electronic war map that was updated constantly in Cyprus from the Liberty's input. The British were about to make good on the promise they had made to the Arabs after the Suez debacle in 1956, when they had abandoned their Israeli ally and told the Saudis that they would support the Arab case on Palestine. Parenthetically, they continue to do that, and much of the utterly skewed BBC coverage of events vis-a-vis Israel and the Arabs is a direct manifestation of saying BBC, although it has some very good points. People, particularly in this country, should be aware that the BBC is inextricably linked with British intelligence. Where the BBC per se leaves off and MI6 picks up, MI6 being British Foreign Intelligence, is anybody's guess. And so when you listen to NPR stations and you hear the BBC, bear in mind that this is basically MI6, and bear in mind that they are carrying on the legacy just discussed. Beginning again, the British were about to make good on the promise they had made to the Arabs after the Suez debacle in 1956, when they had abandoned their Israeli ally and told the Saudis that they would support the Arab case on Palestine. In 1967, the plan was for the British to hand the final product of the Liberty's intelligence haul to the Egyptians. The finished war map was a detailed order of battle intelligence report, or OB. It is the most useful information generals can have in time of war. Using such a map, they can send their troops wherever their enemy is weakest and exploit an undefended region with an attack that penetrates the enemy's rear areas and cuts off its supply lifeline. Our sources insist that with the Liberty's assistance, the Arabs might have been able to turn the war around to some extent, or at least force an honorable stalemate. For the first time, they would know as much as or more than the Israeli generals did themselves about the movements of the Israeli army. The Arab generals would have details of every Israeli counter-strategy from the moment it began. They would have every Israeli battle order in close to real time. Just as the Israelis were beginning to pull some of their mobile reserves out of the Sinai for the Golan assault in the north, the Liberty was letting the Egyptians know the location of each hole in the southern front. As soon as the Israeli army turned its attention to the north, the Egyptians could launch low-level but irritating attacks on Israeli settlements and military formations in the south. You have to understand what this means, said one of our sources. The government of Israel was already pissed off about the CIA leaks to the Jordanians, but that was nickel and dime stuff. This was as serious as lung cancer. As long as the Liberty was transmitting, every Israeli troop movement would be known to the Arabs within an hour, maybe within minutes. It meant that Israel could lose the war. And what we're going to do next is to examine the Israeli decision to go ahead and attack the Liberty. And again, one of the things that's quite striking is the actual nature of the attack. If the Israelis had wanted to sink the Liberty, that could have been done quickly and easily and with deadly effect to the crew members. But the pattern of attack where they first strafed, then after a period of time, once the crew was below decks, they dropped napalm on the ship to melt the aluminum transmitting facilities. And then, after the crew had had a chance to seal the watertight doors, they put a single torpedo into the electronic processing center, thereby not sinking the ship, but neutralizing its ability to basically process intelligence. And Loftus and Ahrens discussed the decision to finally attack the Liberty. It came down to a choice between 25,000 of their own dead or attacking one American ship. One fighter bomber loaded with high explosive ordnance could blow the Liberty to splinters. Cabinet members asked if there was any option other than drowning nearly 300 American sailors, for no matter what the American politicians had done to them, Israel had always been friends with the American people. A plan to put the ship out of commission with a minimum loss of life was requested. Somehow, the Israelis had obtained a copy of the ship's building plans, and the Liberty's fireproof and waterproof compartments gave the IDF staff an idea. The general staff reported their minimum damage plan to the cabinet. During the first run, the aircraft would fire only light rockets at the antenna masts and strafe the deck. That would send the crew scurrying safely below decks to their battle stations. As soon as they were buttoned up, the second run would drop napalm to burn off the antennas and communication gear without breaching the structural integrity of the fireproof hull where the crew was hiding. The one problem was the electronic intelligence center below decks in hold number 3. One carefully aimed torpedo could take that out without sinking the ship, but whoever was in that compartment would die. The Israeli military staff estimated that American casualties could be kept to a few dozen. Most of the crew, maybe 80 to 90%, would survive it. It was the best they could do. The cabinet members gave the order to disable the Liberty with minimum loss of American life. Because they could no longer trust their own telephones, they sent a courier to the nearest Israeli air squadron to ask for volunteers. Half the squadron refused to fly because they had friends or relatives in the United States. They just could not bring themselves to shoot at the American flag, unquote, said one of our Israeli sources. The ones who did fly were heartsick. Two of the pilots later had nervous breakdowns. The Americans on the ship were not the only victims of the Liberty incident. Two American-born Israelis volunteered to fly in the squadron. The air crews needed only a little while to unload the heavy explosive ordnance and replace it with napalm canisters. It took longer to get the torpedo boats briefed and underway. Everything had to be coordinated for 2 p.m. so that the planes and torpedo boats arrived at exactly the right times, one after the other, like a ballet sequence. If the napalm was dropped too early, crew members might still be on deck. The Israeli torpedo could not be fired until the Liberty's crew had sufficient time to close all the watertight doors. In the meantime, a reconnaissance plane would make one last pass over the Liberty to confirm its identity and position. Only then would headquarters give the attack order to launch the fighter squadron. The reconnaissance pilots made the report in code using a scrambled device. Tel Aviv used the same precautions when giving the attack order as it knew U.S. intelligence was listening. The lead pilot on the strafing run would not break radio silence until he had made visual contact. He was then to announce en clair when the ship was in sight. And then the actual physical attack is described here. All morning, there have been overflights by Israeli reconnaissance, 9 passes in all. One of them flew less than 200 feet from the ship, so close you could see the pilots and give them a friendly wave. No one could mistake the Liberty for an enemy ship with its American flag flying and its U.S. Navy identifiers gleaming in large white numbers on the hull. The number of flybys was unusual, but the crew thought that the Israelis were just keeping a constant eye on their position to make sure that a friendly ship did not sail into harm's way. There was a war on, after all, but the Liberty was minding its own business. It was really nothing more than a floating radio set, very lightly armed, and a threat to no one. Parenthetically, most of the Navy crew had no idea about the NSA team that was on board doing the electronic intelligence operations. Continuing. At 2 p.m., another flight of Israeli Mirage jets appeared on the radar screen. A few people on the bridge watched their approach with idle curiosity. Suddenly, the Israeli aircraft opened fire and strafed the deck of the Liberty with machine gun fire and rockets. People were screaming and running for cover. The Israelis left as quickly as they had come. They must have realized their mistake and broken off the attack. For a few seconds there was silence and then the sound of wounded men calling for help. The rockets and gun rounds had chewed up the deck and everyone on it. Some of the radio antennas had been badly damaged, but the Liberty still managed to get an emergency message to the 6th Fleet that it was under attack and needed immediate air cover. While they waited for the U.S. planes, another huge American flag was hung on the Liberty to prevent any further possibility of misidentification. Instead of the promised American fighter support, however, Israeli Mistar jets were spotted on the horizon. Everyone took cover. The Israeli planes fired rockets at the Liberty and dropped napalm, which is a kind of jellied gasoline that burns everything it touches. Some components of the Liberty's radar dishes and antennae were made from aluminum. The only problem is that aluminum does not melt, it burns when it's hit with napalm. Walls of flames rolled over the Liberty. As soon as the jets left, the crew rushed out to try to control the fires. Where was the American fighter support? They should have been over the Liberty minutes ago. What else could go wrong? That was when they saw the 3 speedboats approaching from the Israeli coast. They were not rescue craft, they were torpedo boats. One torpedo struck the starboard side of the Liberty and the stricken vessel tilted 10 degrees over, its steering gone, portions of the deck still burning. Luckily, the watertight compartments below decks had contained the torpedo damage. The ship wouldn't sink, but that was the least of the problems. The captain of the Liberty realized that something had gone terribly wrong and the ship was alone. There was no American air cap to protect it, and it had become a floating target for the Israelis. Although the upper structures of the ship had been badly hit, almost 90% of the crew had been below decks and were still alive. After the Israeli torpedo boats picked up his crew and realized they were Americans, his ship finally would be safe. The problem was that the Israeli boats were slowly circling the Liberty, firing at anyone who stuck his head out of a hatch. The 3 rubber rafts they did manage to toss over the side were ripped to shreds almost before they hit the water. Finally, the Israelis left for good. Out of the 293 crewmen aboard the Liberty, only 34 had died. The crew thought it was a miracle that so many had survived. And then continuing with the account of the Liberty incident and the subsequent cover-up. As soon as the attack was underway, a senior official of Israeli intelligence paid a surprise call on his CIA counterpart. He told them what they were doing to the Liberty at that moment and why. Before the second Israeli run even arrived over the ship, the CIA had told the Navy to call off air support for the Liberty. Although upon hearing news of the attack, the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff at first wanted to launch a quick retaliatory airstrike in the Israeli naval base which launched the attack, unquote, this idea was quickly rejected. There would be no retaliation of any kind. Why were the U.S. fighter planes, which had taken off while the debate was still underway, ordered back to the carrier and the retaliation strike abandoned? The Israelis had proof that the U.S. government had committed an act of war against Israel by betraying its military secrets to the enemy in the middle of a war in which Israel's very survival was at stake. The Israelis had sources in the Arab world that the CIA didn't even know about. The CIA's low-risk strategy had blown up in its face along with any hope of plausible deniability. The White House certainly wasn't happy, but it didn't take long to work up a cover story. The American intelligence officers begged the Israelis to pretend that the attack on the Liberty was a mistake. To make it look good, Israel would be quietly reimbursed for whatever compensation it paid to the surviving crew members and the families of the dead. By 4 p.m. that afternoon, the deal was cut. According to our sources in the intelligence community, the governments of Israel and the United States have spent the next 27 years lying about the Liberty incident. There is a substantial amount of circumstantial evidence to show that this version of the affair is correct. There is, moreover, convincing and direct evidence to demonstrate that the official versions told by both governments are false. And by way of cueing this up to present-day circumstances, as I've noted a couple of times, throughout the entire Six-Day War and the Liberty incident and much of the cover-up, the U.S. ambassador to Israel was Wally Barber. By the way, last name, B-A-R-B-O-U-R. Wally Barber was a right-wing Democrat closely associated with petroleum interests. He was an LBJ patron, basically, or he was patronized by LBJ from Texas and also close to the oil lobby. Wally Barber's son, again, Wally Barber was the U.S. ambassador to Israel throughout this entire situation. His son, Haley Barber, is a Republican. Although Wally was a right-wing Democrat, his son, Haley, is the Republican governor of Mississippi. Furthermore, Haley Barber's New Bridge Company is a major beneficiary, along with Dick Cheney's company, Halliburton, of contracts in Iraq. New Bridge Strategies also does cross contracts with the companies associated with Al-Taqwa, as we looked at in For the Record 433. So there's a bit of intergenerational heritage at work here. Concluding the discussion, Loftus and Aaron's right. As a result of the Liberty incident, the White House gave Wally Barber, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, a new set of marching orders. No further intelligence was to be gathered on the Dimona nuclear reactor, nor were joint anti-Israeli operations to be run with the British and Canadian secret services. Israel was to be the main ally of the United States in the Middle East and was now more important than Arab oil. Well, that may have been true during the Cold War, but no more Cold War. And now, folks, what it's all about in the Middle East, yeah, it's a three-letter word, all right, but it ain't J-E-W, it's O-I-L. I believe it is the Kazakhs, the population of Kazakhstan, a former Soviet Central Asian republic that's now an independent country. They refer to oil as the devil's tears. Amen. Please do get in the habit of using the Spitfire website and linked websites with some of the programs that I've done over the last several months in the wake of the Lebanon War. The descriptions are absolutely essential. For example, in the Middle East Matrix series, there is information available in the descriptions, most of it, by the way, coming from those relatively few responsible conservative websites that are available. There aren't actually very many conservatives around. Most of them are fascists. People calling themselves conservatives are fascists. A real conservative wouldn't touch very much of what this administration has been doing with a 10-foot pole. But there are some, and some of them have done a good job about some of the huge distortions of information about the recent Lebanon war. But in general, use the Spitfire website, www.spitfirelist.com. With regard to, for example, to For the Record 571, there was a recording glitch, and I wasn't able to get a lot of the information I'd planned on putting into that broadcast into it. It will be in the description. www.spitfirelist.com, the For the Record section, has long article-length descriptions. There's a mini-library available for download for free on very easy-to-download PDF files of old, out-of-print anti-fascist books. There's a search function. There's a link to a website with the declassified government documents proving the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry before, during, and after World War II. There is a blog sphere. And there's also the most underused page in the Spitfire website is a page you can use to support the work that I'm doing. And if you don't like the things that are going on around you, there's no better way of fighting back than supporting the work that I'm doing. My name is Dave Emery, and this concludes Side 2 of For the Record number 572, The Liberty Incident, being recorded on October 8th of 2006. Thanks for listening.